Monster Man, Episode 155, Orym Vorax and Azur. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In today's episode, we are finishing the A chapter of the Monster Manual 2, the 1983 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. We're going to be talking about a big, shiny, badger kind of critter, and a dwarf who's on fire. But before we do that, it's time to thank some patrons and answer some listener mail. First off, welcome to new patrons. I've got three new patrons to thank this episode. Those are Chris McGurr, Brendan, and Zachary Cox. These are people who've gone to patreon.com/monsterman, and they've pledged as little as $1 a month to support the show. People who pledge at the $2 or higher level get access to my bonus podcast, Patron Deities. But $1 patrons get some bonus content as well, including I'm just about to start a few episodes on monsters from classic indie RPG the World of Cinnabar by Raven C.S. McCracken. So if you want to find out more about that fever dream, you should pledge and check it out. Thank you all very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. Your support means the world to me. Next up, some listener mail. Now, we had a question a while back about collaborative bestiaries, and Guy Fullerton provided some examples. He said that other recent collaborative monster books include Monsters of Myth, which is an early Osric supplement, and Malevolent and Benign, where you can see there the name inspired by the Fiend Folio, and he says it's a collection of new monsters from the early set of Advanced Adventures modules. And Petty Gods. I had a copy of Petty Gods. That's right. It's not a monster book per se. It's a collection of deities, but it's got that same kind of like crowdsourced quality to it. And as Guy points out, these Petty Gods are pretty petty. They're weaker than quite a lot of the high level monsters in most of the monster books that we've been covering. So Guy, thank you for those recommendations. Listener Simon Perrins commented about the Squonk, a monster from White Dwarf that I mentioned a couple of episodes ago, and he says that it's a creature from American folklore, which is the subject of a song by Genesis. This is also mentioned in a Steely Dan song, and suggests that, you know, in the early 80s, quite a lot of beardy British gamers might have been listening to these bands, which I think is pretty on the money. And in fact, I can't believe I didn't know this, because the Squonk is one of the creatures in Fearsome Creatures of the Lumber Woods, one of the essential collections of American monsters. It's from 1910, was written by William Thomas Cox, who was the Commissioner of Conservation and State Forester of Minnesota, and it's just a collection of folkloric monsters that kind of lumberjacks or other, you know, woodland professionals will talk about it, and it is a marvelous. Also, it's a, quote, a few desert and a mountain beasts. It's quite short, but it's got some amazing monsters in it. So in addition to the Squonk, it covers things like the Hugag, the Gumbaroo, the Roperite, the Funeral Mountain Terrashot, the Tote Road Shagamaw, the Wapaloosie, the Cactus Cat, the Hodag, the Whirling Wimpus, the Argapelter, the Snow Wasset, the Bildad, the Tripodero, the Hyampom Hog Bear, and much beloved of fans of the Tunnels and Trolls RPG, the Snollygoster. So, really just a fantastic collection of fantastic beasts. So, good looking out there, Simon. And finally, listener Glenn Robinson points out that if you're listening along to our coverage of Deities and Demigods, that Deities and Demigods co-author Jim Ward has just started a series of articles on Ian World, reminiscing about his time at TSR and his later game development work. Now, the first one is up, and it's mostly just an introduction, but I'm going to be keeping a careful eye on it to see what he has to say about the books that I'm covering, and, hopefully we'll get some insights from one of the authors himself. And if you're interested in the history of early Dungeons & Dragons, I think that could be a really cool thing to read. So if I remember, which is about a 50-50 shot, I'll put a link in the show notes. So thank you very much, everyone. It's wonderful to get all these reminders and recommendations from my very knowledgeable audience, and just kind of to hear what everyone's thinking about the show. So thank you very much for writing in. All right, let's take a look at some monsters. Our first creature for this episode is the Orym Vorax. Now, like a lot of creatures in the Monster Manual 2, the Orym Vorax actually appeared in a scenario prior to this. It is in 1980's Expedition to the Barrier Peaks by none other than Gary Gygax. And it is basically a big, eight-legged kind of wolverine or badger-looking creature. It's super dense and strong, and the implication seems to be that it's made out of metal. It has kind of coppery or golden color to lots of it. It has extra dense structure, so it takes half damage from bashing weapons and things like that. And it's quite dangerous, actually. It does that thing where it bites, and then if it bites, it clings on, and it attacks with all of, well, with a randomly determined number of its little leggies. And although each individual hit doesn't do a huge amount of damage, you know, it's hitting with a lot of them. So it's got that bite and rake thing, so you're going to want to try and get it off of your comrade once it's bit down. The name is translated as the Golden Gorger in Monster Manual 2, and that ties in with the idea of it looking like a mustelid, because, of course, the Wolverine is called Gulo, the glutton. So there's definitely the idea that sort of Wolverines are greedy animals, and that this is a bit like one. The Ouroboros has another interesting facet, which is that your English teacher could use it as an example of that thing they always tell you about avoiding the passive voice. Now, avoiding the passive voice is a piece of advice that's given to kind of beginning writers. As you develop your skill, you'll discover that, you know, sometimes it's appropriate and sometimes it isn't. But this would be one of those instances where the passive voice is not appropriate. So once the Ouroboros has grabbed hold of you, the entry tells us, dexterity of the opponent is negated for computation of armor class in this case. Or, this attack ignores the dexterity bonus to the opponent's armor class. But that would be too simple, I guess. Anyway, I'm not here to make fun of Gary Gygax's pro style, but there are certainly times when it is needlessly complicated. And say what you like about the rather plain efficiency of the writing in some later editions of D&D. At least if you need to find information in a hurry, it is sometimes a little more useful. I quite like the Ouroboros. I'm very fond of mustelids as a type of enemy. I don't know why. I think wolverines are more interesting than wolves, mainly because they're just not so overplayed. Like, wolves work in this very specific situation, right? You don't want Dracula to be listening to the snuffling of the wolverines through the window of his castle. You know, wolves have a certain atmosphere about them. I think I just quite like ferocity and brutality as qualities of monsters. I think we've established that. One of the reasons I like bugbears so much. And bugbears are much more like wolverines than they are like wolves. There's no nobility to a wolverine. And I think there's no nobility to the Ouroboros. It's another weird animal, and I like weird animals in general. So, overall, I'm pro Ouroboros. Next up, we have the Azir, or Azir. These are dwarf-like creatures who inhabit the elemental plane of fire. They look like kind of charred-colored dwarves with fiery hair and beards. Quite a striking and impressive color scheme, I think. I think the Azir look pretty good. And I do think that it's nice to see dwarf-like creatures that are fiery rather than earthy. Like, if you were going to associate dwarves with an elemental plane, you'd think earth. And I feel like earth is kind of the obvious answer, and the fiery Azir are actually pretty cool. I also really like the description of the personalities of the Azir that is given here. They're neutral, they're not evil. And so it just says that they're kind of like surly, they're unfriendly, they're mainly motivated by greed. Which is to say that they're kind of exaggerations of the characteristics of dwarfs that often get turned into, in player character dwarfs or in dwarfs that the PCs have to interact with a lot, grumpy but lovable. They're just grumpy, not lovable. And I think that that has a great deal of value. There's a description of their leader, Amaimon. He's just a big Azir. Whatever, he's fine. And then it also talks about their fortresses, which are big, stark, black basalt towers, which I think is a pretty cool image. It makes sense that they'd be on the elemental plane of fire right there, kind of volcano bases, and you can see the seas of magma roiling around them. That's pretty cool. And it says that they actually have these particular defenses around their bases, like giant bellows for projecting air, or big supplies of water that they can use to splash down on their attackers, which makes sense because their enemies on the elemental plane of fire would be other fiery creatures. And they, being rather dwarf-like, I guess, are kind of good at engineering, and so they're figuring out how to use those elemental creatures' vulnerabilities against them. Although, where they're getting all this water on the elemental plane of fire, I'm not so sure. The elemental plane's never made a whole lot of sense to me, but whatever, it's pretty cool. I do like a good volcano base. The elemental planes, and indeed the sort of not-prime material planes in general, seem like a good place to do stuff that makes no sense. You know, every time that you're like, well, why is there even this castle in the middle of nowhere when there's nobody else around? It doesn't really make sense in terms of how populations work. But it makes total sense on outer planes that run more by kind of symbolic logic than practical logic. I mean, maybe, I think my D&D game tends to be a bit more symbolic than practical anyway, right? If I want the enemy general to be riding around the countryside in a gigantic fortress golem, which is, you know, a mobile dwarven fortress that he's chained and enslaved, and he's launching his ornithopters off the back of it, which I did have in my game. Like, that does not make an enormous amount of sense from a strictly logistical or military standpoint, but it's so cool that I wasn't going to leave it at. What was I saying? So, I actually think the Azir are pretty cool. I don't see where they come up very much. I did use them in a previous game as inhabitants of a volcano base that the bad guys were hiding out in, and I think they work okay there. I think there's a sense in the Monster Manual, too, that now that we're some years into Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, we're getting toward a mature game where players are maybe getting a little tired of the basics and are more interested in doing things like fighting higher level or more complex opponents, playing more narrative games, right? We're coming up on the age of scenarios like Ravenloft or Dragonlance, and indeed exploring the other planes and getting beyond kind of the fantasy cliches. This has sometimes been lamented by purists and OSR types as a loss of innocence, but I think it's an unavoidable consequence of the game's success, which is that if the game is successful, people are going to be playing it for a long time, and once they're playing it for a long time, they're going to want to vary it up a little bit. The basics of it, the dungeons and fighting orcs and the cleric has a maze and the wizard cast magic missile and so on, are going to maybe feel a little bit repetitive. And so, given that the game tends to cater toward its hardcore fans, you're going to get more and more of these options. I think if the Monster Manual 2 was out when you started playing the game and you bought both it and the Monster Manual and sat down and read them, it would be quite a weird feeling, because you're going to look at the Azir and go, I don't know what I do with this guy, in a way that you don't when you look at Buccaneers in the Monster Manual, right? I think the Azir are pretty cool. I really like their visual, and they're one of the planar creatures that has stayed in modern D&D basically being exactly the same as they are here, which I think is a testament to how effective they are. So yeah, I quite like the Azir. All right, that is it for the A section. In our next episode, well, actually, our next episode is going to be a special episode all about the famous Tucker's Kobolds. But in the episode after that, we're going to get started on the B section. We're going to include the Baku and the Bandarlog. So join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.